You know, it's my great pleasure right now to introduce to everybody a man who really needs no introduction.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King.
Carl. I'm not calling the fans geeks. I'm not calling them rednecks, tobacco chewing nothing, because I've done all that myself.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King. Carl.
In your dreams, you will see me.
Excuse me, please, let's don't talk negatively.
I'm going to win the title. I'm going to keep my money and buy me some good old Tennessee drinking whiskey with it.
Thank you for being such a great husband.
And this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold, baby, just like you and me.
Hey, everybody. This is Carl Stern here, and I've got a couple questions for you. Do you ever get frustrated that you can't watch certain live sports events because they aren't televised or available in your country? With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a country that is showing the sports event you want to watch so you don't miss out and can watch the action live. You may have heard VPNs are great for online protection, but they slow down your internet speed. Luckily, NordVPN is the fastest VPN in the world. You won't even notice it's running, so you can stream and game online with no buffering or lagging. Furthermore, NordVPN prevents your internet service provider from bandwidth throttling, so you can have a consistently reliable internet connection. It's the price of a cup of coffee every month, a small price to pay for premium cybersecurity and access to a vast amount of entertaining content from all over the world. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/F4W to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan for 4 months free. Is completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Let me tell you that link again. It's nordvpn.com/F4W.
Hey, everybody. Carl Stern here for the second show in our examination of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame ballot for 2022. If you missed part one, you probably need to listen to it because it talks about all the new voting changes. There are new rules. There are new criteria for voting for members of the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And for expediency's sake, we won't be able to cover those on this show. And you also will have missed several candidates being discussed on that show. So please go back and listen to that one. So we're going to pick up here and continue our examination. We are in the historical performer era candidate, and we're a little over halfway down the ballot for that one. And I chose to stop last episode because, number one, for time, but number two, because the next ones we need to discuss are very significant tag teams. And again, go back and listen to part one. There are a ton of tag teams on this year's ballot. There is a new way to consider tag teams. The focus this year seems to be on tag teams, which, in my opinion, have been historically underrepresented in the Hall of Fame because of the way they had been considered. So now, with some changes made, let's talk about Harley Race and Larry Hennig. So this is Larry the Axe Hennig, the father of Kurt Hennig, grandfather of Kurt's son. What was his name? He wrestled for a while there in WWE as well. He had two or three different gimmick names, Curtis Axel and whatever. That was named after Larry the Axe Hennig. So Harley Race, we know Harley Race, Hall of Famer, obviously, 8-time NWA World Heavyweight Champion, a major standout star, world traveler, huge deal in the United States and Japan, and obviously, no question, Hall of Famer. Larry Hennig, on the other hand, is not in his singles career, and not met up to that standard. And really, Larry Hennig, the thing he would be most qualified for being in the Hall of Fame for would be consideration along with Harley Race as this tag team. They were multi-time AWA World Tag Team Champions and really one of the all-time great tough guy tag teams. Now, I didn't get to see this team at the time they were wrestling. This was well before my time as a wrestling fan, starting in the late 1970s. And because by that time, Harley Race was your perennial multi-time world heavyweight champion. Larry Hennig was only wrestling occasionally. He would occasionally do special matches for the AWA. His son Kurt was rising through the ranks when I first started, you know, watching wrestling, following the newsstand magazines. In fact, Kurt was kind of an enhancement wrestler in WWF and getting a little bit of a push over in the Pacific Northwest. So that's where I knew Larry Hennig from. So I don't have a wealth of first-hand knowledge watching Larry Hennig and Harley Race as a tag team. Just know the stories. Just know the facts and the figures as I've chronicled them in the When It Was Cool Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling Timeline, which I have spent an exhaustive amount of time on. Thousands and thousands of pages of wrestling history there. And so in entering all that, obviously I get exposed to a lot of stuff, a lot of results, and quite frankly, a lot of it runs together. And but there are certain things that catch my eye and catch my attention. And, you know, I think Harley Race and Larry Hennig as a tag team are certainly very well considerable for this. They don't just blow me away as slam dunk Hall of Famers, not like a team we're about to talk about here in a minute, but they're certainly high up on that list. So of all-time great tag teams, when you think about them, we've already talked about British Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation, and those teams are a lot more, I think, famous. They had a lot more exposure because of the television era, the expansion, cable, WWF becoming so popular during the time period they were there. And so Harley Race and Larry Hennig were big stars before that era, before this modern time period. And so they're handicapped a little bit in that there's less to know about them. So I would defer to more older historians, those who have more researched that era for Harley Race and Larry Hennig, but they just don't blow me away as slam dunk Hall of Famers as a tag team. I think they're considerable. I think they are, you know, if somebody produces some research that I can really look at and study, but just based on what I know and what I've seen and putting together the wrestling history timeline and, being exposed to their legacy after the fact, I think, yeah, they're a legendary tag team to be sure. They're a very famous tag team. Are they a Hall of Fame tag team? I can't say no. I mean, I can't say no because I honestly feel like I need to know a little bit more fact-wise about, you know, their how they shows they worked on, how did they draw, who were some of their best matches during that time period. Is there any footage of that? Probably some, but not a ton. So I want to educate myself on Harley Race and Larry Hennig a little bit more before I decide one way or the other. Right now, I kind of put them around that borderline era, subject to change. Now, Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch are probably more famous as a tag team than Harley Race and Larry Hennig, the Texas Outlaws. Their time was early in the career of both Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch, so this was way before my time. Although because Dusty Rhodes was such a charismatic promoter and performer and often referenced, you know, his team with Dick Murdoch, and they reformed this team a few times later on in the 1980s, even up into the 1980s, although it was just, you know, for brief flurries of time, certainly nothing Hall of Fame worthy. The reign of terror of the Texas Outlaws was way before my time, and certainly they were a big drawing team. They were very nationally famous. They were well traveled, certainly with the charisma of both Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch. They are much talked about. Many of the stories about the Texas Outlaws seem to revolve more around their outside the ring or extracurricular exploits, their craziness, than actually what they did inside the ring. You know, even Ric Flair, when he first broke into the business, was a huge fan. He was mentored by the Texas Outlaws, Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch. He wanted to be a protege of Dusty Rhodes. Remember the story, Ramblin' Ricky Rhodes? He wanted to be, Ric Flair wanted that to be his name, and they nixed it. And so Ric Flair has, over the years, you know, really embellished their legacy as well by telling stories about them. And so many people would probably hear about the Texas Outlaws and just assume they're Hall of Fame caliber tag team. But do their accomplishments, do their matches, do their drawing power, does that actually meet Hall of Fame criteria? Were they trendsetters? Well, there's a lot of these wild, brawling tag teams. I mean, I don't think they did anything really innovative that Crusher and the Bruiser wasn't already doing before that. I just don't know. I mean, they're very famous, to be sure. And when you hear the Texas Outlaw, I think your gut reaction is, yes, they must be in. But again, I think I want to do more study on them. I think, I have a feeling, and I reserve the right to change my opinion about this, as I go through and put in all these results and news stories and stuff from that time period in the wrestling timeline, I haven't been just blown away by the dominance of the Texas Outlaws. I mean, they were, again, a well-traveled team. There are tons of stories. My gut reaction is, seems like a team that should be in there, right? But let's really examine that. I need to see more about Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch and hear more conversation about that before I make up my mind. So I'm putting them, and they're sort of contemporaries with Harley Race and Larry Hennig, in a time period that I need to do a little more in-depth research. My strength as a historian falls in the pioneer era of wrestling. That would be, you know, the William Muldoon up through the original Strangler Lewis, Farmer Burns, Colonel James H. McLaughlin. I wrote one of the proposal pieces to get Colonel James H. McLaughlin in the Hall of Fame, along with Matt Farmer and others. Really, we picked up the torch to put McLaughlin in, and he got in. So that era there is really my strong suit. That and the 1980s, from about 1981 through about, you know, the Monday Night War era. That's my strong point. So I am a little weak, quite frankly, in my knowledge of the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and even the early 1970s. While I have done a lot of research into that and certainly do a lot involving the wrestling timeline of that, I'm not by any means going to qualify myself as an expert on that. So that's what's fun about the Observer Hall of Fame, is this time of year gives me opportunity to read research and read conversation from other people about Harley Race, Larry Hennig, the Texas Outlaws, and people like that. Now, your next team on this list is one that I am very familiar with and have spent the better part of the last year really looking up and really doing some research on. And in my opinion, they are the strongest candidates on the Hall of Fame ballot right now. Yes, I think of singles and tag teams of any ilk. Argentina Roca and Miguel Pereira. So this became quite evident to me as I'm working on the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling timeline, and I'm working on the, you know, the late 1950s through 1960s era. And, you know, Madison Square Garden was fairly consistent as far as their attendance goes. There were some fluctuations, but it was nothing like Memphis. I mean, Memphis, Mid-South Coliseum, despite what you may hear to the contrary, it fluctuated widely based on really the main event, whether Jerry Lawler was there, whether the world champion was in town. Like, the attendance there greatly fluctuated. Madison Square Garden was, generally speaking, pretty stable. Now, I'm also doing, and you may have heard, listen to these shows, the history of wrestling at Madison Square Garden. And we're in the very early days now. But as we go along, I want you to pay attention to the consistency of wrestling at Madison Square Garden, especially when you get up into the 1950s, 1960s, and whatever. You know, sellout with Felt Forum and all that. So, you know, a little over 21,000. But generally speaking, you could pretty much bank on attendance at Madison Square Garden being between 15,000 and 20,000 people, regardless of what was going on. But it seemed like during the 1950s and 1960s, this trend fluctuated a little more than had been in the past, except for the fact that I started noticing, you know, the shows without Antonino Rocca and Miguel Perez as a tag team, there was a significant drop-off, And, you know, shows with them as a team was a significant increase. Like I started, it became so much of a pattern that I began paying attention to it. Antonio Inoki, obviously, he was a huge draw. And Argentina Rocca was a giant draw as a singles wrestler, no question about it. All over the country. I mean, he was a pop culture star. He was on the cover of the Superman comic book, for Pete's sake. He was, you know, very, very tremendous. And more so than, you know, he's really one of those guys. We talk about Buddy Rogers. We talk about Lou Thesz and Bruno Sammartino and all these legends from that time period. And it seems like for whatever reason, we've stopped in modern times talking about Argentina Rocca. And we should. We should be talking about Argentina Rocca because he was a giant draw. But he and Miguel Perez together as a tag team, there was something very, very special. Now, Miguel Perez really in the United States, in Puerto Rico being a territory of the United States, he was a big star there. But in the continental United States, Northeast especially, Miguel Perez never really struck me as that big of a draw just by himself. I've noticed numerous examples of Miguel Perez being on the card with no noticeable change in attendance. But you put Argentina Rocca and Miguel Perez together, and it is very notable. And Dave has even said they were perhaps, and I can't really demonstrate anything to the contrary, perhaps the greatest drawing tag team of all time. When you think about tag team wrestling, it was seldom ever really the main event. Now, there were periods of time in Jim Crockett promotion where it was, but for most promotions, it was, well, I mean, it started really in the 1920s and 30s. The Welch family really were the ones that popularized tag team wrestling. You always hear San Francisco, but evidence suggests it was actually probably the Welches that really popularized tag team wrestling in Appalachia. And so it was kind of a special attraction, like a battle royal or, you know, having a giant on the card, like a Haystacks Calhoun or something like that, or having, you know, a wrestling bear on there. It started out as a novelty act. And so it was seldom ever the serious main event until maybe Argentina Rocca and Miguel Perez really popularized it, especially there at Madison Square Garden, and made it. And look, hey, this is an era where tag teams were exploding. The Kangaroos were coming out, being very successful themselves, and I believe they're in the Hall of Fame already. And if the Kangaroos are in, there's no question Argentina Rocca and Miguel Perez as a tag team goes. And I'll go so far as to say, once again, that of every single person, whether single or tag team on this ballot, in my opinion, the most inarguable candidates on this are Argentina Rocca and Miguel Perez. So it's an absolute definite on them, no question about it. I think the statistics are solidly there. If you go over to whenitwascool.com and go to the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling Zone and start in the late 1950s, say about 1958 or so, and go up into the early 1960s and just, you know, search for Perez or Rocca and look and see for yourself, you know, how many shows north of 15,000, north of 18,000, 20,000 that feature Antonino Rocca and Miguel Perez very high on the card. Now, with Madison Square Garden, calling something the main event is, you knew what the main event was, but it's not necessarily placed on the card in that. A lot of times the main event of the world title match would be in the middle of the show. And WWF, back then WWF, Capital Sports, whatever, was, you know, infamous for doing this so they could begin selling tickets at intermission for the next month's show. So it's hard for me to say, you know, at any point in time. Like, I'm looking right now at a March 17th, 1958 show at Madison Square Garden. The attendance is 15,140, and on the show you have Rockin' Perez beating Hans Schmidt and Dr. Jerry Graham. And I look at the card, and I'm honestly not sure what the main event is. I don't, you know, there is Ricky Starr, there's Eduardo Carpentier beating John Tolos, Ricky Starr beating Ludwig von Krupp. Obviously, that's not the main event. Bolo Hakala beating The Sheik, I'm sure by DQ. That's probably not the main event. Pat O'Connor going to a draw with Carl Von Hess, not a main event. Roy Heffernan of the Kangaroos battling Chief Bigheart to a draw. Al Costello beat Kip Fox. Pepe Chicaro, who is Hercules Cortez under a different name, beat Larry Moikin. Sid Youngleman beat Bob Langvin. I mean, so your main event on that almost certainly was Rockin' Perez against Schmidt and Graham, right? So you run into a lot of those situations where it's hard to say exactly, you know, exactly what the main event, whether they were in the main event or not. There's one very famous one, 20,333 people from May 24th, 1958, where Rockin' Perez beat Larry Hamilton and Joe Hamilton, and that would be your future masked assassin, Joe Hamilton, Jody Hamilton, and the Missouri Mauler, Larry Hamilton, wrestling as the Hamilton Brothers, one of the youngest teams ever, youngest people ever to headline Madison Square Garden. And they headline against who? Rockin' Perez. So, you know, that was a big, very well-known card. Rockin' Perez feuded with the Fargos, Jackie Fargo and Don Fargo at Madison Square Garden, drawing, you know, a good gate there, you know, over 15,000 for that show. And wrestling, of course, the Grahams were very popular back then as well. The Kangaroos against the Kangaroos, as a matter of fact, 1958, August 9th of 58th, Rockin' Perez beat the or went to a no contest with the Kangaroos, that being Costello and Heffernan, 20,169 people. So again, a near sellout for there. And there's, you know, you just repeat that time after time. October 1958, Rockin' Perez beat the Sheik and Bull Curry, who's also again on this ballot here, 20,793. So, again, you know, you put them on there against the Grahams, Eddie and Jerry Graham, not December of 58, 20,350 there. So when you talk about, you know, Bruno Sammartino and Pedro Morales and all these legendary draws at the Garden, you absolutely need to put in your mouth the name of Rocca and Perez. So no question about it, Hall of Fame. Without really any hesitation whatsoever.
Excuse me, please. Let's don't talk negatively. Speaking of winners, surprise, surprise, whenitwascool.com is your home for retro pop culture articles and podcasts. To all our patron supporters, this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold just like you and me. Family friendly and fun. whenitwascool.com.
Johnny Rougeau is a very interesting candidate as well. Paul Sosnowski, who has been doing a tremendous amount of work on the Ultimate History of Wrestling timeline, had sent me in a lot of results from Canada, specifically Toronto and Quebec, and that's how I become, you know, familiar with Johnny Rougeau. My only connection really to the Rougeau family was watching Jacques Rougeau come up through Southeastern and Memphis wrestling, and then later, of course, he and Raymond and in the WWF, and then later Jacques, of course, is the Mountie. I really had no connection to the generation prior to that. But Johnny Rougeau, the numbers, I think, are certainly there as far as a huge draw in Canada, a huge star there. Again, internationally speaking, the case, I think, lacks a lot. He was never, you know, promoted as a major world champion in any of the major promotions. So you're going based on, you know, solely his work there in Canada, and maybe you should. Maybe the case is very well there. I would have to refer to more wiser historians like Pat LaPrade or someone like that for your Johnny Rougeau. I would listen to them and read their works and come to the conclusion on Johnny Rougeau. I'm not convinced myself to vote for him, but I have yet to really start my research phase for this year's ballot, and I will certainly be referring to this, especially Pat LaPrade's work on Johnny Rougeau, and he's been on several podcasts here at Wrestling Observer as well, so you may want to listen to those to determine whether you think Johnny Rougeau deserves inclusion on there. I feel like my ballot's going to fill up way ahead of Johnny Rougeau, but I don't want to get, I'm certainly not saying he's not going to be on there. I'm just saying I can think of a lot that I want to vote for before I get to Johnny Rougeau, but I want to go through my timeline and look at that. Like I said, I know Paul has sent in quite a bit of stuff on Johnny Rougeau that I have put into the timeline, and I was very well impressed with, you know, what has shown up thus far. The tag team of Kenji Shibuya and Masa Saito, I'm not an expert on that. I know very little about that team. I'm going to have to see a case made for that. My gut instincts know, since I don't, you know, as I do more and more work on this timeline and do so much data entry for really every single territory out there, I don't recall Shibuya and Saito really catching my attention that much in there. Maybe it should have. Maybe I'm overlooking something. Maybe there's a gap there still to be filled in once I resume that project, but I don't know. Dave was a huge Kenji Shibuya fan. He's the one that wanted him solo in the Hall of Fame. As far as them together as a tag team, I'm going to need more information there. Tiger Jeet Singh is somebody I feel like has been on this ballot forever, but perhaps they dropped off and come back. I don't know, but I just don't see Tiger Jeet Singh. I know very famous, you know, the feud and stuff in Japan with Inoki. Beyond that, I don't know. Maybe I just, you know, maybe there's a hole in my knowledge there as well, but I just don't see anything I've run across in doing the timeline or my own research or anything like that that just screams, hey, Tiger Jeet Singh, Hall of Famer there. Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood. Now, that's a curious case there. I mean, we're talking about one specific period of time. It wasn't like, you know, Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood became this long time, you know, tag team in many different territories. We're talking about really one territory for the most part, Mid-Atlantic, Crockett Promotions. Yes, I know that's not the solo only place they ever worked, but that's the bulk of their Hall of Fame argument is going to come from there. Again, you know, Sergeant Slaughter, not in there. Don Knoodle, certainly not in there. Slaughter and Knoodle together. I mean, you got, when you say Steamboat and Youngblood, you got to say Slaughter and Knoodle as well. So I don't know. I mean, rest in peace, Jay Youngblood. He died very young. He certainly had some extracurricular problems. Ricky Steamboat, obviously, you know, no question, a Hall of Famer is Ricky Steamboat. The tag team of Steamboat and Youngblood, great, legendary, whatever, but, you know, I just don't know. I just don't think so. I mean, my gut says no, especially since we're not considering Slaughter and Knoodle as a team. And Steamboat's already in. So of the two people, the one that's absolutely, unquestionably deserves to be in the Hall of Fame is already in it. So we're really talking about whether we want Jay Youngblood in there or not. And I don't see it. I just don't see the case there. But again, you know, you're welcome to make your arguments. And I will certainly consider them and read them where appropriate. Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon, again, another famous name of a tag team. Very famous brother duo as a tag team. To me, they fall below the criteria. I just don't see. There's nobody on this ballot that is just, to me, inexcusable. Like, you look at it and just go, no way do they even deserve to be on there. So Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon certainly deserve to be on the ballot. Now, what I can't testify to and will not attempt to testify to is their Canadian work. Again, Pat LaProd is probably where you need to go to find your information about the Vachons. And he may make a fabulous one. In fact, I'm going to look through some of his books and look and see what he's had to say about Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon. And I may come back when I finally do my ballot with a completely different story. But again, that's what makes this time of year so fun. That's what makes this Hall of Fame ballot so interesting, is you get to sit down and really concentrate on some people who you may not be that experienced in seeing or know that much about. You can kind of learn, and it's a great time to do that. Finally, another tag team, Mr. Wrestling 1 and 2. You know, Tim Woods and Johnny Walker, they're going to get a firm no from me. I did not think Mr. Wrestling 2 as a solo wrestler deserved to be in there, and he did not get in. Them as a tag team, I don't think so either. There's more, you know, there is more to, or I shouldn't say there's more to, there's less to the team of Mr. Wrestling 1 and 2 than I think most people realize. Yes, they were a team. Yes, they were a successful team. But, you know, their joint work together just really, I just don't see a case for it at all, really. Now, also should be on this ballot, on this historical ballot, but isn't, is Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson. And again, with J.J. Dillon, and again, I say this every year, why are we linking the three of them together? Take J.J. Dillon off this, so you can also consider Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, with Bobby Heenan also, and J.J. Dillon, their time in the NWA, in Crockett Promotion, as part of the Four Horsemen, as NWA Tag Team Champions, and also consider them as WWF Tag Team Champions, their feud with the Rockers, them being managed by Bobby Heenan. And then, even then, I think it's a borderline case, quite honestly. But just, I just can't comprehend why we're linking them with J.J. Dillon only, and literally taking away their run in the biggest promotion in the world. Now, yes, they were more successful, more, you know, top of the card and all that in Crockett Promotion and NWA, WCW. But WWF was the biggest company in the world. They performed in front of the largest crowds when they were with WWF. They were managed by Bobby Heenan. They were WWF World Tag Team Champions, and yet you can consider none of that by linking them as a trio. So I'm not even, like, I rant about that every year, and every year they Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, J.J. Dillon show up on the ballot, and I just can't figure it. All right, Junkyard Dog. We've talked about Junkyard Dog many, many times. There are some people that are very fanatical about Junkyard Dog absolutely being in the Hall of Fame. I understand he, as a cultural New Orleans, Louisiana icon, you can't take that away from him. If you've got a Louisiana Hall of Fame for pro wrestling, then Junkyard Dog's your number one guy. If you've got a Louisiana Mid-South area Hall of Fame for entertainment in general, add in rock bands and you know, actors and actresses and sports figures, Junkyard Dog is still in there. He's absolutely in it, no question. As far as an all-encompassing international pro wrestling Hall of Fame, he just doesn't make the cut. And I have actually, I've had people unfriend me, I've had people curse me and everything else for refusing to vote for Junkyard Dog, although I am in the majority and not voting for Junkyard Dog. That's why he's still on this ballot after a million years. You would have thought he would have made his 15 years by now, but I guess he just keeps staying on there somehow. He just don't cut it. I've become less impressed by his credentials, because literally the only thing you've got as far as Junkyard Dog being a Hall of Fame competitor is his time in Mid-South, a few short years there in New Orleans specifically. His time in WWF was not that great. He was a very much mid-card performer there. His matches were largely terrible. If you watch that WrestleMania match against Harley Race, that in and of itself almost disqualifies both of them. That match was so bad. In WCW, he was horrible. His career was not that long, at least competitively speaking. Bill Watts, on commentary, just about every week Junkyard Dog was there, was complaining about how worse and worse shape Junkyard Dog got in. So it just ain't happening. Junkyard Dog is just not a Hall of Famer. Now, I like Junkyard Dog. I like watching Junkyard Dog on Mid-South Wrestling. One of the last WWE action figures I bought was that Mattel Junkyard Dog Elite figure. And I love it. I think it's great. He's not a Hall of Famer. He's just not. He just doesn't cut the criteria. And again, I read all the criteria. If you're seething bad right now and you're unfollowing me on Twitter and blocking me on Facebook and whatever, go right ahead. But go back to that first episode where I read the criteria and see how many boxes Junkyard Dog clicks. Now, maybe you disagree with the criteria of the Hall of Fame. That's valid. I understand. I disagree with some of it, too. I think people get in way too young and not with enough years involved to get in the Hall of Fame. I disagree with that portion of it. But that ain't how the Hall of Fame's worded. So if your problem is that, it's not with me, it's with Dave, for that being his criteria to get in this Hall of Fame. And Junkyard Dog checks very, very few of the boxes. So Junkyard Dog, loved him, thought he was great. I like when I go in my collection room to see that Junkyard Dog action figure there. It's front and center. I got him right up there with Hulk Hogan and superstar Billy Graham and Ric Flair and Terry Funk and all my favorites. Right there in front, Jerry Lawler. I got all my favorite wrestlers from when I was a kid pulled up there front and center, and Junkyard Dog's right there with him because Junkyard Dog was great. I love that time period. We teamed with my favorite wrestler, Mr. Olympia. Love the team of Junkyard Dog and Mr. Olympia. Put them on the ballot. Put them on the ballot. They're, to me, they're as qualified as Mr. Wrestling 1 and 2 to be on there. I wouldn't vote for them, but I'm just saying. They were great. Not Hall of Fame. Ditto for the next team. The next team is two of my favorite wrestlers ever growing up, Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. Jerry Lawler, I don't care if you like him or don't. It's fine. There's plenty of reasons not to like Jerry Lawler. I like him as a wrestler. I liked him as a performer. I liked him for all those, years he spent as a super entertaining guy there in Memphis. I loved his promos. I liked Bill Dundee. I recently did a biography podcast on Bill Dundee. Go grab that off my website if you'd like to hear it. But what did they do as a tag team? Yeah, they won the AWA World Tag Team titles when AWA was literally nothing anymore, and they only held them briefly to transition them over to the Midnight Express, Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose, not even the most famous version of the Midnight Express. What in the world? I mean, yeah, they were probably 10 million times Southern Tag Team champions, but people were coming out to see Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee solo, not as a tag team necessarily. They're just not Hall of Fame. And again, it's confined to Memphis. It's not anywhere else. Yes, they were AWA World Tag Team Champions, but they basically only worked Memphis and maybe Chicago and Minneapolis. But that was only for a short period of time as a team. So, no, I don't even know why they're on the ballot. Edge. We've talked about Edge for many, many years. Edge has been on there a long time. Edge is like the definition of a borderline candidate for me. Some years I've voted for him. Some years I haven't voted for him. I listen to arguments. I've heard arguments in the past that give me numbers and statistics. And I look and go, yeah, you know what? It's a pretty fair case for Edge. And then I see other people and I listen to their arguments. And I think, yeah, okay, he's dipped back below the watermark for me. He's still right there. If I end up making my list of 18 people, Edge may be number 18. He may be number 19. That's very possible where Edge is going to fall for me. I can't fault anybody for voting for Edge. I can't fault anybody for not voting for Edge. I think he was influential in some ways, especially with these crash TV kind of matches, like your ladder matches, your table ladder and chair matches. He and Christian together as an act. you know, all that considered, I think he's got a strong case for being on the ballot and a mediocre case for being in the Hall of Fame. And nothing I've seen, read about, or heard for this latest run with him in WWE has changed my mind one way or the other for Edge. Again, he remains very much on the no pun intended, edge of my ballot. While I'm talking about Edge, I'm going to put somebody else in there that I consider right alongside Edge, CM Punk. Very topical, very newsworthy person is one Chick Magnet Punk, presently sidelined from AEW because of extracurricular activities. He, you know, stripped of the AEW world title. And, you know, I have never been a fan of CM Punk. He's just never done it for me, never impressed with him. That doesn't mean I can't read and understand statistics. And I look at those, and I know he has a very passionate fan base. Again, people have gotten very mad at me in the past for being medium on CM Punk. I still remain so. But as AEW, when they signed CM Punk, I thought, hey, here's, you know, this may put him over the top. Let's see if CM Punk moves the needle. And guess what? He did. He made a demonstrative difference in ratings and attendance for AEW. But boy, was that short. And he seems super injury prone. He seems very disruptive. Maybe he's in the right in this situation with the Young Bucks and all that. I don't know. I can't speak to that. You've all heard the same stuff I've heard. I can't say one way or another. We'll let Tony Khan's investigation just investigate itself all the way out, and then maybe we'll get some answers and know. But what I do know is that he is a controversial fella who appears to be sometimes difficult to get along with. What does that have to do with the Hall of Fame? In my opinion, not much. He's still super borderline to me. I know that infuriates some of you, and some of you, laugh and giggle with glee. He's still, if he would have stuck out this AEW title run longer, so we could have seen the trajectory of what AEW was going to be under CM Punk as heavyweight champion. Does it get hot? Does it get cold? Does he maintain? Where does it go? I would have had a much more clear idea. But just like Edge, if I make out that list of 18, CM Punk's going to be somewhere between, you know, 14 and 20 on that list. He may get it. He may not. Right in there. That's my thoughts on CM Punk. All right, Bill Goldberg. Bill Goldberg, I think, is a very interesting candidate, more than most people. He, again, yes, he hasn't maintained a consistency. He, like Ultimate Warrior, was in and out of the business. He was not, his in-ring performance was not necessarily up to par. I mean, ask Bret Hart. But that's not what he was as a character, for what he's supposed to be. The Road Warriors, for Pete's sake, they are in, and rightfully so, in the Hall of Fame. Bill Goldberg is very much of that same ilk, and in my opinion, very equitable to the Road Warriors. So to me, if the Road Warriors are in, you got to consider Bill Goldberg. He was a huge draw in WCW. He basically stabilized and popularized that company at a time where, you know, there along with the NWO, super red hot. I mean, the numbers are there for him. If that were his only run, his only time, his only consideration for the Hall of Fame, he would be probably borderline, but I would still consider him a viable candidate. Well, every time they bring him back to WWF, WWE, for the most part, he has been successful. It's been a positive. I think it's added to his case, even though he just, you know, comes in and goes away, comes in and goes away, comes in and goes away. So consistency is his biggest knock, And in-ring work is also one of his biggest knocks. But his popularity, fame, drawing power, the strength of his presentation, I think he's a Hall of Famer. I do. And I know some people just, their heads just exploded. Oh my God. But CM Punk does the go to sleep and he likes Japanese wrestling. How can you even say that? Well, because I said it. Because if you give me the opportunity and whatever, to watch Bill Goldberg wrestle Hulk Hogan in front of the Georgia Dome, in front of 40,000 people, and have a punch and kick match that's, they clubber their way through, or watch CM Punk against pick anybody in the world where they could do their moves and stuff, I'm picking the Goldberg-Hogan match every time, and I don't feel bad about it. Because, pro wrestling is more than just your fancy flips. It just is. And pro wrestling is about presentation. It's not necessarily about reality. We've seen CM Punk fight. He can't fight. He can't. Not to shoot. Not a bit. He's terrible at it. We don't know if Goldberg can or not. Only fight we know of Goldberg getting in was with Chris Jericho, and Chris Jericho apparently controlled that situation pretty good. By the way, check out my appearance on Talk is Jericho recently. Thank you, Chris. But, Goldberg, looking at him, you go, wow, there's a guy that could kick your ass. There's a guy that could kick my ass, Bill Goldberg. CM Punk, pretty sure not. So, again, so what is pro wrestling? It's the presentation of athleticism, of character, of tough guys. Bill Goldberg, to me,'s got all that. I understand a lot of people mad about what happened to Bret Hart. I am too. I mean, Bret Hart's great. He's absolutely great. It is a detriment to Bill Goldberg that he was sloppy. It is definitely a detriment. And if there are people that don't want to vote for him in the Hall of Fame for those reasons, because his in-ring performance was so subpar, I understand that, and I think it's a viable reason. So that's why I think he's a borderline Hall of Fame candidate. But for me, I think he's a megastar. I think he was an absolute megastar and totally worthy of getting my vote. Now, whether he will or not, I don't know. He may not break that eight. There's quite a few people I want in above him. He's not near the top. We know he ain't going to be number one because we know Antonino Rocca and Miguel Perez are number one on mine. So, he ain't getting that slot, but he may be on down there. Matt and Jeff Hardy, another interesting story. Again, very much in the same stratosphere as Edge and Christian. As a tag team, they certainly, in my opinion, outperform Edge and Christian because based on longevity, Jeff Hardy's popularity, they seem like very likable people. They've had, we don't have the territories anymore, but if we did, they've kind of made the rounds around them. WWE, TNA, Impact, AEW. I mean, they've kind of been around the block a little bit with different, but did they move the needle? Yeah, I kind of think they did. I think they've got a solid argument. Again, they're not Rocca and Perez, not even close, but they're viable candidates on this ballot. Becky Lynch, again, I've said my thing about female wrestling, ladies wrestling. It's not my thing. I don't keep up with it. Don't pay attention to it. Don't watch it. So I ain't qualified to say whether Becky Lynch is or not. She seems like a needle mover. I mean, there's no question she had a hot period there where, undoubtedly she was a very positive in the business metric. So, that seems to me, just based on what superficial knowledge I have about the career of one Becky Lynch, seems like there's reason to believe she should be on this ballot. But as far as whether she should be in or not, I'll leave that to more qualified people to determine. Kevin Nash and Scott Hall as solo wrestlers, no, not even. The NWO is a trio. You got my attention there, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and Hulk Hogan. But as them as a tag team, I mean, tag teams were even de-emphasized in this era, where they were so successful as a tag team in WCW, as an act there. Their matches, I mean, name me some great Name me these great tag team matches with the Nasty Boys where they, you know, about concussed each other to death and stuff. I mean, what are these great Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, you know, Hall of Fame worthy tag team matches? I just don't see it there. All right, it becomes more and more evident we're not going to be able to do this show in two parts either and keep it under the F4W Online guidelines. So we're going to go to part three of this show. But before we do, let's talk about one more candidate. Let's talk about two more. We'll get both Paul Orndorff and Randy Orton on this one. Paul Orndorff, a pretty strong case, but for a short period of time. He was, you know, as he come through the territorial system, I watched him there in Southeastern Wrestling. I watched him in Georgia, watched him in Mid-South. And he, you know, he's building up a great case for being a future superstar. He gets to the WWF, you know, that feud with Hulk Hogan, one of the all-time great feuds, one of the all-time great WWF money-drawing feuds. He is super important to establishing Hulk Hogan as that long-term WWF champion. He's plan B in case Andre the Giant doesn't work out at WrestleMania 3. I mean, it's the arm and neck injury that derails an otherwise headed for Hall of Fame career. To me, Paul Orndorff doesn't make it because of longevity and because he got injured. And yes, he was well on his way to a Hall of Fame career. Then he takes several years off of wrestling. He comes back. He does Smoky Mountain Wrestling. He does a WCW. But, you know, he's a shell of his former self at that point in time. So Paul Orndorff, he's on the ballot, and to me, he was a guy who is most definitely on his way to a Hall of Fame career, just stop short of it. Randy Orton's Hall of Fame ballot career is as uninteresting to me as his wrestling career, in that he's got all the tools, he's got many of the statistics, and he is the most boring human being I think I've ever known in my life. I'd rather watch paint dry is to watch Randy Orton for 15 minutes do anything. He has accomplished the least with the most. Randy Orton is a no and always has been for me and always will. He is the perennial snatching defeat from the jaws of victory is Randy Orton. All right, so we've talked about one CM Punk. The New Age Outlaws, Billy Gunn and Road Dogg, we'll go ahead and mention them too. They're a big no from me. Again, DX as a group is perhaps considerable, but them as a tag team, not so much so. Again, you are no Rocca and Perez, that's for sure. Trish Stratus, again, I'm not, you know, commenting nor voting on any of the female competitors, as I have not paid enough attention to their careers to know anything about it. Rick and Scott Steiner, I can't believe they didn't get in last year. Absolutely deserve to be in. I put them very strong up on the list. They don't have the drawing statistics of Rocca and Perez, but in their in-ring work, their fact that they were very successful in WCW, WWF, New Japan Pro Wrestling, I mean, they've got the travel, they've got the match quality, they've got the innovations, no doubt about it. Rick and Scott Steiner, I don't know how they didn't garner 60% last year. They certainly should be considered this year. Finally, and hey, we'll get through this section so we can do our Japan, Mexico, and other places on the third and final ballot show. Let's talk about Kevin, Kerry, and David Von Erich. No way. Jose, not happening. You know, they didn't. Their story is a cautionary tale and a tragic one, not a positive one. Yes, they were basically rock stars in Texas. Junkyard Dog was basically a rock star in New Orleans, and he's not cutting it. I loved Kerry Von Erich. I thought he was great. Got a Kerry Von Erich Mattel Elite action figure standing up in my collection room as well, probably in close proximity to my Junkyard Dog. They are both equally viable candidates. But even putting Kevin, Kerry, and David together is a big no. They didn't For number one, they didn't any of them live long enough. Kerry lived to the age of 33 and had already been washed up for a number of years when they should have been entering their athletic prime at that point in time. David was probably on his way to a Hall of Fame career, but didn't live long enough. Kevin just, I mean, again, Kevin is the Randy Orton of world-class wrestling in that he figured out a way to do the least with the most, and so he's a big no for me as well. All right, so that is part two of our Hall of Fame show. Please check us out at whenitwascool.com. If you want me to pick up and resume work again on the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling timeline project, I'm going to need some more support. I need to get back up to a certain goal. It's listed there on our Patreon. So once you come over and support us, I was on average putting 100 typewritten pages worth of material into the timeline every month. I just can't sustain that degree of a time sink without it being financially solvable to do so. So only you can determine if that is a project worth continuing or not. So if you think it's worth $1 a month, if you think it's worth $5 a month, then that gets you all of our podcast over there as well. Come check us out over at whenitwascool.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back very soon with part three of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame Ballot for 2022.